Yesterday, Los Angeles lost a significant part of its cultural landscape. Dutton's Books closed its doors for the last time. It's the latest in a stream of independent bookstores going out of business. NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates visited Dutton's on closing day.
Doug Dutton's customers started lining up at the doors of his bookstore in the Brentwood section of Los Angeles first thing in the morning. Everyone wanted to say a fond goodbye to the store that had been a cultural touchstone for the city and to its owner. While his staff rang up deeply discounted last-minute sales, tearful friends came bearing flowers, which Dutton accepted with a wry joke.
They usually bring these to funerals. I'm not sure. Is that what's going on here?
Pretty much. After 24 years in business, Dutton's Brentwood has called it quits. Back in the quiet of his stockroom, Doug Dutton explains that the sky-high price of Brentwood real estate is one of the reasons he's closing. It would be too expensive to keep this signature space.
Here we've had this sort of rambling shell of a building that surrounded a courtyard that was, for all practical purposes, a reader's park. It had a very much of a community neighborhood feel.
David L. Ulan, the editor of the Los Angeles Times Book Review, says with Dutton's closing, Los Angeles is losing more than a bookstore.
There was some kind of indefinable feeling of comfort, of culture, of intelligence, and I think that that's irreplaceable.
Dutton's was a reader store, a place where prominent authors wanted to come and read and where new authors were nurtured and encouraged. Doug Dutton says helping new authors blossom was one of his greatest pleasures.
What could make you prouder? I mean, it's very much like a parent with a child. You see the success of these people who you like and you admire, and you're as proud as can be when they break onto a bestseller list or chosen for a book award.
Paula Yu is one of those authors. She dreamed of having a signing at Dutton's for years and worked up her nerve to ask about doing that when her first novel was published.
They asked why I wanted to have it at Dutton's, and I said, well, this is the bookstore where I would hang out in your cafe and write and scribble away in my notebook, and some of my novel was originally written at your cafe, so it was sentimental, as well as I think it's a great bookstore.
Photojournalist Lester Sloan came for coffee in the morning and returned to document the store's last hours in the evening.
I wanted to be here for the last goodbye, you know. I live around the corner, and this was like my sanctuary.
Sloan says Dutton's really was common ground for the rest of Los Angeles.
And this was a place where nothing mattered. You know, you left your identity outside, so to speak. And it wasn't uncommon to see Dustin Hoffman or Helen Hunt sitting in the corner, or Whoopi Goldberg in the back there.
At Dutton's, it was all about the books. As the evening wore on, people continued to stream in to hug the staff and pick up a few more books.
Hey, how are you doing? You too.
Tables in the courtyard groaned with homemade baked goods brought by loving customers, and champagne corks popped. Despite the store's closing, Doug Dutton was a happy man.
You have these visions of final sales, of people pawing over things and pushing you out of the way and grabbing for it. It's been a very civilized, lovely experience, and people handing other books to people say, oh no, you should have this. It's been wonderful. It's really been wonderful.
An extraordinary ending for an extraordinary place. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
Over the decades, Louise Erdrich's best-selling and critically acclaimed works of fiction have formed a kind of crazy genealogical quilt. Imagine her novels and stories as brightly colored squares, the characters and plots as threads that weave them together. The books are full of family trees and stories of life among the Native and the new Americans on and off the reservations of the Upper Midwest. A new square is added when her novel A Plague of Doves is published. It began as a short story. Louise Erdrich is in the studios of Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul. Welcome back to the program. It's nice to talk to you again.
It's nice to talk to you, too. My pleasure.
I want to start with just the title of this, Plague of Doves. Plague is the correct collective for doves, but it's the first story in what becomes a family saga that is told by a girl and her grandfather. But tell the story, the very first one that first appeared in The New Yorker, that forms the title.
The title actually came out of a very old clipping. And the incident that begins the book was an actual incident. There was a plague of doves, and the congregation of a Catholic church was gathered in order to try and walk through the fields praying and dissuading the doves from eating all of the crops. This was in North Dakota. It haunted me as some of the other historical pieces in this book did, and it took a long time to put them together, but this particular story also includes one of my favorite characters from North Dakota history. Her name is Mustache Maud. She was a real woman. She was a real wrestler. She was a real rancher. And she did pick up a pig from time to time.
Mustache
true.
Maud.
She'd wrestle pigs, and I always loved her. It's a great picture of her in some of the historical books I'd read, and I just couldn't resist somehow getting her into a book. I'd always been waiting for this moment.
Yeah, really. But she doesn't show up again. I mean, you know, that's the first story, and you're setting the stage for what we learn about Evelina Harp and
right.
her grandfather, Musham.
Well, thank God these books are all related, because maybe I can get her back in somewhere.
That's
I don't know
true.
If she...
That's true. So we have this story, and we have this incident that you based the first short story, and then that expanded into the novel. There's another story, and it is really a vortex of this particular one. It's a lynching that happened in, mm-hmm. was it 1911? And it affects every character in the book.
Yes, and that is from another true event. And that event was so powerful for me that it stayed with me for 20 years.
What was the basic story?
The basic story was there was a brutal murder of a farm family in Emmons County, North Dakota. There were three Native American men hanged. One of them was only 13. He was just a boy. I came across a picture of this hanging not long ago. It was sold on the internet, and they'd used a beef windlass. It's a tremendously troubling event in my mind.
What is a beef windlass, did you say?
A beef windlass is a place where you hang a beef after you've killed the cow and you're going to butcher it.
Mm. So you were able then to take this story and create your characters around it, because one of them is Musham, the grandfather, who is hung but not hung to die. He's cut down.
Right.
And then the relationships that exist between the mixed-blood families, the tribal families, and the white families all around this land near the town of Pluto that straddles the border, you know, between the reservation and outside
yes.
the reservation. So it becomes, did it, a metaphor for everything that you were trying to tell about not only early history, but contemporary history as well?
And what I'm trying to do is tell a story that goes back and forth through time and that shows the influence of history on the passions and the decisions of people who live in the present.
You talk about all the strange. It was strange that lives were lost in the town's formation. It is the same with all desperate enterprises that involve boundaries we place upon the earth. By drawing a line and defending it, we seem to think we have mastered something, what the earth swallows and absorbs, even those who manage to form a country, a reservation.
I'd hoped that something like that resonated today in our the hopeless grip that nationalism has upon so many of our countries and has upon so many of us. It all does come to nothing in the end, and that's the truth of history.
And there's a chapter called The Kindred, and it's set on the land, and it has to do with the followers
yes.
of a rather charismatic preacher named Billy Peace. And, you know, as I was reading it, I couldn't help but think about the story that's happening now with the children and the families in West Texas. Are you following that at all?
Oh, sure I am.
Yeah. Does your story compare? I mean, you do have a woman with young children who, you know, ends up escaping from the sect and a wonderful scene in the diner where kids are eating Sundays for the first time. But it's amazing that you've come up with a story to tell about a similar kind of occurrence on that same piece of land.
It may not be so odd. It seems to me that every few years, you know, the United States discovers some kind of unbelievable cult, you know, and with unbelievable practices and with charismatic leaders and people following doing things that nobody can believe. And it's part of it's part of our cultural life, it seems, to discover and rediscover these sorts of enclaves of what people generally think of as madness, but within seem, you know, I guess, quite self-contained and sane.
And it just, isn't that interesting? I mean, your stories really are all connected. I can see, you know, you're having a character and all of a sudden you realize he's related or she's related to someone you had, you know, several years ago. That's what I meant in my introduction to you about this kind of quilt. Where do you think you do your best writing or your best thinking?
I have a little room up in my attic. And I have a lot of food up there. I'm not starving up there. And it's warm. And it's where I go. It's just a little tiny room.
Are you always working on the next project when the current one is coming out into the public?
I always am. I always have something else to go to. I would be so bereft if I didn't. You know, the other place I work is when I get trapped in a motel. Sometimes when I'm on the road, you're almost desperate to get away mentally. I've written some of my best stuff. So that's when it happens.
Louise Erdrich, her new novel, A Plague of Doves, is published by HarperCollins, and she joined us from the studios of Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. It's good to talk to you.
Remember a few years ago when the hit movie Chocolat hit movie screens? That's chocolate for those of you who are those of us who are language impaired. It was the ultimate chick flick. Juliette Binoche, Johnny Depp, lots of chocolate. Now the author of the book that inspired the movie has written a sequel. And Martha Woodruff reports from member station WMRA.
In The Girl with No Shadow, Joanne Harris revisits the world she created in Chocolat, one where ordinary-seeming people don't quite live ordinary lives. Which certainly describes the author's childhood.
I had a great-grandmother who believed in so many strange superstitions that I was infused with these beliefs from an early age. She used to tell the future from the things that catch on to the hem of your skirt when you've been sewing, and different coloured threads would mean different things, and if a black cat crossed your path, it could be bad luck coming from one side or good luck coming from another, and certain flowers were bad luck, and certain signs were good luck, and of course, all that influenced me quite a lot as a child.
Is that child still alive in you?
Totally, yeah. She's writing the books now.
Joanne Harris's 1996 novel, Chocolat, introduced us to Vian Rocher, maker of magical sweets, on the page as winsome and winning as Juliette Binoche was in the 2000 film adaptation.
The pepper triangle, that's for you.
Tiny hint of chili pepper to play against the sweetness, tangy, adventurous.
I hadn't realized at the time of writing Chocolat how much history and folklore has been attached to it.
Joanne Harris says the appeal of chocolate is that we all know it's both delicious and somehow wrong.
We've always had this kind of built-in idea that confectionery and witchcraft are somehow linked. The idea that from the witch in the gingerbread house, of which the tiles were made of chocolate, to the Snow Queen and her enviable capacity to conjure up Turkish delight out of thin air, there's always been this kind of link between witches and confectionery.
In The Girl with No Shadow, 5 years have passed since Vian Rocher closed the door of her shop in a picture postcard French village. Mother now of two daughters, Vian is attempting to live a quiet, non-magical, dutifully maternal life in Montmartre. and this life is just not working.
If Chocolat is milk chocolate, The Girl with No Shadow is dark chocolate.
Joanne Harris describes this chapter of Vian Rocher's life as a dark urban fairy tale.
Chocolat was very much about what makes you happy, whereas The Girl with No Shadow is what makes you afraid. And Zuzi, who is, I have to say, my favourite villain so far, has got the edgy attraction that you get from what frightens you and what's dangerous.
In this passage from the novel, as Vienne's older daughter first catches sight of Zosi, she mistakenly sees in her all the magical light and playfulness that her mother once had.
From the back, at first I thought I knew her, the bright red coat that matched her shoes, coffee cream hair tied back with a scarf, and were there bells on her print dress, and a jingling charm bracelet around her wrist? And what was that? That faintest gleam in the wake of her, like something in a heat haze.
Joanne Harris says she took up Vian Rocher's story again because it just didn't feel finished after Chocolat.
There might be a third book, who knows? I don't think that this is necessarily the last chapter in her story.
But the author hastens to add that she, like the rest of us, will just have to wait and see if Vian Rocher and her magical desserts will reappear yet again to tempt the appetites of readers. For NPR News, I'm Martha Woodruff.
We're going to talk next about a private detective who was completely a product of his time, but whose story has endured into our time. The detective is Philip Marlowe. He's the creation of the novelist Raymond Chandler. And in the minds of many readers, he might still be wandering the streets of Depression-era Los Angeles, solving crimes and letting off wisecracks like this. I needed a drink. I needed a lot of life insurance. I needed a vacation. What I had was a coat, a hat, and a gun. Philip Marlowe made it through tough times. And after 9/11, a modern novelist wrote that we needed to be inspired by that same character again. So now we've performed our own investigation. NPR's Mike Schuster has the latest installment of In Character, our series exploring famous American fictional characters.
Raymond Chandler began to develop the Marlowe character in short stories and novellas he published in pulp fiction magazines like Black Mask and Dime Detective. Marlowe emerged as a fully realized character in novel form with the publication of The Big Sleep in 1939. Marlowe was cool, smart, world-weary, even droll. He dressed in dark gray suits, lived in lonely rooms, worked in empty offices. He seemed a perfect fit for Humphrey Bogart, who starred in the 1946 film version of The Big Sleep with Lauren Bacall.
You know, I don't see what there is to be cagey about, Mr. Marlowe, and I don't like your manners.
Well, I'm not crazy about yours. I didn't ask to see you. I don't mind if you don't like my manners. I don't like them myself. They're pretty bad. I grieve over them long winter evenings, and I don't mind you ritzing me or drinking your lunch out of a bottle. But don't waste your time trying to cross-examine me.
People don't talk to me like that.
Oh.
The world Marlowe lived in was mean, filled with dangerous men and fickle women. Marlowe was tough, sure, but not cold. Otto Penzler, editor of the Black Lizard Big Book of Pulps, places Marlowe in the tradition of the American Western, transposed to the modern urban landscape.
Chandler saw him and wrote about it famously as a knight, a man of purity, a man of honor, a man of integrity. That was not necessarily true for most of the private eyes who would do whatever it took to get the job done.
Chandler wrote his Marlowe stories almost always in the first person. So Marlowe was the narrator as well as the main character, and he took on something of the literary flavor of Chandler's fine writing. Van Heflin played him in this 1947 radio version of the novella Red Wind.
There was a rough desert wind blowing into Los Angeles that evening. It was one of those hot, dry Santa Anas that come down through the mountain passes and curl your hair, make your nerves jump and your skin itch. On nights like that, every booze party ends up in a fight. And meek little housewives feel the edge of a carving knife and study their husbands' necks. Anything can happen when the Santa Ana blows in from the desert.
The character was so vivid, for some, Marlowe seemed true to life. But Chandler himself challenged that in a 1958 radio interview for the BBC with Ian Fleming.
He doesn't exist in real life.
No, he doesn't.
Unless you can make him seem real.
Yes. Marlowe seems real to me. I mean, I visualize him quite clearly.
Oh, I know, but that's because I've known him so long. That
yeah.
He's not real as a specimen of a private detective.
Yeah.
Fleming and Chandler discussed Marlowe's emotions, which Fleming observed are far more nuanced and complex than his own creation, James Bond.
On the other hand, Philip Marlowe feels them and speaks about them.
He may speak about always confused.
He is, isn't he?
He's like me.
Marlowe makes his way alone and isolated through a highly chaotic world. That's the way Robert Crace sees him. Crace is a writer of contemporary crime fiction. He has written the highly successful novels featuring Private Eye Elvis Cole.
Though Marlowe might feign it from time to time, I never believed Philip Marlowe was a cold, detached man. He was always personally involved on some level. He always felt the pain of the characters he was dealing with.
You alone, Joe?
Yeah, except for this.
Except... My. Such a lot of guns around town. It's a few brains. You know, you're the second guy I've met today that seems to think a gat in the hand means the world with a tail. Put it down, Joe.
Marlowe was tough enough to be regarded as hard-boiled.
Again, Otto Penzler.
But I don't think he wanted to be. He would rather have used his brains in a more sensitive way than a lot of other Private Eyes would have done.
Dick Powell was the first to play Marlowe in a 1944 version of Farewell, My Lovely. The title was changed to Murder, My Sweet. The character comes through even though the tough guy language is a bit quaint today.
I've been out peeking under old Sunday sections for a barber named Dominic whose wife wanted him back.
And I never found him.
I just found out all over again how big this city is. My feet hurt, and my mind felt like a plumber's handkerchief. The office bottle hadn't sparked me up, so I'd taken out my little black book and decided to go grouse hunting. Nothing like soft shoulders to improve my morale.
Later, many actors played Marlowe, including James Garner, Elliot Gould, James Caan, and even Danny Glover, and Robert Mitchum in a remake of The Big Sleep in 1978.
It was close to 11 when I got back to my apartment. I concealed a murder and suppressed evidence for 24 hours, but I was still at large and nobody seemed unduly worried. As I got to the door, I heard my television was on. I wasn't in, so I guess somebody else must be.
Screenwriters have always felt free to adapt Chandler's work to different times and places. There was no television when Chandler wrote The Big Sleep, and this version took place in London, not Chandler's favorite city, L.A. A lot of people think Mitchum was the perfect Marlowe. Among his fans is Robert Crace, who first encountered Marlowe when he was 15 and found The Little Sister in a secondhand bookshop.
I read it that night, literally in one sitting, and it threw open the doors and kicked out the walls for detective fiction, for Private Eyes, for Los Angeles. I mean, all the great loves of my life stem from that book.
Crace's characters, Elvis Cole and his buddy Joe Pike, both take something from Marlowe, but they are their own men. Crace, who has another Elvis Cole novel, Chasing Darkness, coming out this summer, strives for what Chandler achieved, a character that keeps connecting with readers for years and years.
Marlowe was resonant with the public and is resonant even today and to all of us who followed in Chandler's footsteps. At his base, Marlowe is us. There's nothing superheroic about him. He's a regular guy who has somehow found a way to divine order out of the chaos of our lives.
Marlowe lives on. Last year, a pilot was made for a TV series, and there's talk of another movie with Clive Owen playing the Private Eye. Mike Schuster, NPR News.
For more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.